Hello and welcome to the History of Singapore, episode 40, The Mercy of the Tungku. Last week, we discussed how Lee Kuan Yew, in his desperation to find an issue that he could use to win the 1963 election, sought to convince the leaders of UMNO to agree to the reunification of Singapore and the Federation of Malaya. This week, we focus on Tunku Abdul Rahman and his relationship to Singapore. As we have established, the Tunku and the leadership of the United Malays National Organization, or UMNO, were adamantly opposed to merger. The single most important reason for this was the fear that the incorporation of over a million Chinese would immediately threaten and ultimately abolish Malay political dominance and power in the Federation, or more specifically, UMNO's dominance and power in the Federation. UMNO was and is and remains a Malay nationalist party. They equated Malayan culture and identity with Malay culture and identity and demanded that minorities should assimilate to the Malay culture and accept the privileged positions of Malays, or more specifically, the privileged position of UMNO in the Federation. And they brought this same argument to the debate on the reunification of Singapore with the rest of Malaya, which we call merger. Now, the Tunku did actually publicly consider merger on several occasions before the fateful 1961 announcement. On 26 December 1955, on the eve of departing for London for talks on Federation independence, he suggested that if Singapore felt too small a territory to achieve independence on its own, it might consider joining the Federation as a member state. He also extended this invitation to Sarawak, Brunei, and North Borneo. The response of the Singapore press was prompt and heartfelt. Editorials declared Singapore's readiness to reunite with the Federation. But at the same time, the Tunku reiterated the special position of Malays in the Federation, which the integration of Singapore's Chinese would threaten. And he said, I quote, "If we create a single nationality, Malays will lose their special position, which we are committed to uphold and maintain," unquote. The Chinese newspapers felt this was, quote-unquote, deeply unfortunate, and they reiterated their loyalty to Malaya. Likewise, the Straits Times worried about the, quote, "growing division between Singapore and the Federation," noting that the separate resolution of the citizenship and nationality issue will make reunification impossible, unquote. Thus, merger was regarded as something which could only be achieved in 5 or 10 years, not immediately attainable. The Tunku did not publicly bring up merger again for another 6 months, but on the 2nd of June 1956, he announced, again, he would welcome Singapore, Sarawak, Brunei, North Borneo into a, quote, "greater Malaya, if they themselves come in voluntarily after they attain independence," unquote. But he also made it clear that he intended this proposal for a distant future. Separately, in a statement to the Nanyang Shangbao London correspondent, the Tunku commented that he was prepared to accept Singapore Chief Minister David Marshall's proposals for merger and agreed that Singapore would be proportionally represented in the Federation Legislative Council based on population size. He would also allow Singapore to retain a high degree of autonomy. But he repeated that he could not accept Malayan citizenship being granted to all Singaporean citizens. This would grant Federation citizenship to Singapore's large number of foreign-born Chinese citizens. And the Tunku's views reflected beliefs shared by most leaders of UMNO. Although the ruling alliance was based on interracial cooperation, the political order was predicated on Malay political dominance, or more specifically, as I keep emphasizing, UMNO's political dominance. Even if Malay political control was constitutionally guaranteed, Chinese economic predominance might eventually overturn it, or worse, convince Malays to vote for a party other than UMNO. So this position was the essence of UMNO objections to merger throughout this period. In response, as always, the Nanyang Shangbao reiterated Chinese loyalty to Malaya and argued that the Chinese had always coexisted peacefully with other ethnic groups throughout Southeast Asia. The Chinese had fully cooperated and shared in Malaya's economic development, and both sides needed to trust each other to succeed. If Malaya would not trust its Chinese and grant them a clear path to citizenship, then Malaya's Chinese had no reason to be loyal to Malaya. So the Nanyang Shangbao editorial concluded that clear guidelines for the foreign-born to become citizens would remove the citizenship controversy. No more difficulties would then remain in implementing a Singapore-Malaya merger. Thus, the contours of the merger debates were already well established by 1956. Singapore's Chinese wanted equality for their culture and education, protection for Singapore's free trade port, and at minimum, a clear and equitable path to achieving citizenship. The Tunku and the rest of the UMNO leadership wanted to deny citizenship to the large number of foreign-born Chinese in Singapore, so that they would not be enfranchised to vote in the Federation, and to limit Singapore's political activities in the Federation so that it would not upset the alliance's electoral balance. And the British, meanwhile, had long regarded the merger of Singapore and the Federation as crucial to the security of both the island and the broader region. But merger, everyone agreed, was not likely to happen soon. But the people of Singapore continued to hope. Merger remained a major prism through which events were interpreted. Amid the anger at the repression of October 1956, for example, the use of Federation troops as part of the planned anti-riot operations was seen as evidence of close cooperation by the two governments, demonstrating how both territories were very intimate, were one family. Talk about trying to find a silver lining. The presence of both chief ministers in London in December 1956 raised the possibility that merger would be discussed. Such hopes were then dashed when Lim Yew Hock gave a speech attacking Chinese subversion in Singapore to an audience that included the Tunku, and the Chinese press pointed out critically that Lim's speech would undoubtedly discourage the Tunku from considering merger. The creation of the Internal Security Council at the 1957 constitutional talks was, for all its undemocratic repressive drawbacks, seen as an avenue for closer Singapore Federation cooperation. Again, talk about trying to find a silver lining. That's how bad Singapore wanted reunification, that they could look at an instrument of oppression and say, well, at least both Singapore and the Federation are involved in it. Likewise, the subsequent establishment of a quarterly conference of ministers between the two governments was, quote, very important as a precursor to merger, unquote. More generally, mainstream Chinese newspapers supported any initiative that led to the closer association of Singapore and the Federation, politically, economically, socially, or culturally, as contributing to the eventual reunification of the two territories. This included discussions about a Malayan common market and economic cooperation, numerous discussions on the creation of a Malayan identity and culture, and enthusiastic support for a Malayan language week or even a Malayan language month. The Tunku himself would again make public reference to merger on 24th September 1957 and again in early 1959. And in each instance, he held out the possibility of Singapore and the Borneo states eventually joining an independent Malaya, to an enthusiastic response from Singapore's press. And then the Tunku would back away from these comments a few months later. The newspapers kept reiterating the belief that Singapore and the Federation of Malaya were inseparable, writing things like, quote, originally two parts of a single complete organism, unquote. That the divide between the two was artificial and unreasonable, and that merger should happen as soon as possible. Still, the Tunku had kept his remarks abstract and general to ensure that he could back away from his commitment with no loss of face. He had no incentive for reunification and indeed every incentive to keep Singapore out. Which brings us back to the events of 1961. As we discussed last week, after the loss at Hong Lim, Lee realized just how tenuous his grip on power was. He needed his party's Chinese-speaking leaders to win support from the Chinese-speaking public. But he did not want to listen or share power with the Chinese-speaking leaders in the PAP. He rejected criticisms that he was too arrogant, that he was undemocratic, that he needed to be more consultative. To stay in power, he needed an issue on which he could regain the initiative, which he could monopolize, and which he could win the next election on. So to keep himself in power, Lee Kuan Yew threw everything he had into merger with the Federation. A week before Hong Lim polling day, Lee travelled to Kuala Lumpur to plead with the Tunku, where he argued that only the promise of merger in the near future could save his government from falling into communist control. Argue, or perhaps I should say, lied his ass off. Well, they're one and the same here. The critical issue remained that the Tunku doubted Singapore's Chinese were capable of assimilating into UMNO's vision of a Malaya where the Malays retained their special position. Geoffrey Tory, the British High Commissioner to the Federation at this time, reported back to London that the Tunku said, quote, "We could prove to him, as often as we liked, that Malaya should assume responsibility for Singapore. But the fact remained that the bulk of the Chinese in Singapore were incapable of adopting a truly Malayan viewpoint and therefore of being assimilated safely into the Federation." Unquote. Remember, again, as I keep emphasizing, for the Tunku, Malayan equals Malay. But Lee Kuan Yew's attempts to stoke fears over communism were also beginning to have an impact. UMNO leaders did not want another emergency. The first one was just over. In February 1961, the Tunku publicly declared that, quote, "certain elements among the Chinese are China-minded. If all people were real Singaporeans, then the merger would be no problem at all," unquote. Just 3 weeks before the Hong Lim by-election, he commented, quote, "Merger is possible only when the people of Singapore are completely loyal to Malaya. Otherwise, there is no need to make a request for merger," unquote. And each time, Singapore's Chinese press reiterated Chinese loyalty to Malaya and argued he was misunderstanding the Chinese. But as we discussed last week, I think the Tunku understood Singapore's Chinese all too well. And the fact was, they were not going to vote for UMNO, and that was the crucial factor. But in the week after the devastating defeat at Hong Lim, Lee again went to Kuala Lumpur to talk to the Tunku, and he pleaded and grovelled and begged and pressed his case for merger by playing on the Tunku's fears, telling the Tunku how the election results showed the growing strength of the Chinese communists, that Singapore was more dangerous as a communist base outside the Federation than as a threat to Malay privilege inside it. And Ong Ying Guang's overwhelming victory at Hong Lim appears to have clinched this argument. And shortly after, at an UMNO rally on the 6th of May, the Tunku declared, quote, "There is a section of the Chinese in Singapore who do not want a good government which works for the good of the people. What they want is communist government or a communist-oriented government," unquote. So note how his rhetoric had shifted from calling Singaporeans un-Malayan to instead calling Singaporeans communist. That is the Lee Kuan Yew impact. So by the 26th of May, the Tunku had made up his mind. The Federation could no longer insulate itself from Singapore, and it had to absorb Singapore to prevent it from undermining the Federation. Greater Malaysia was the best route. The electoral issue would be addressed by the inclusion of the Borneo territories to counterbalance Singapore's Chinese population, ensuring that Malay primacy in the Federation would not be lost. Well, what if the Borneo territories didn't want to be part of Malaysia? Well, Who cares what they think? Remember, they're still full British colonies. The British could do whatever they wanted with them. So it was assumed that the British would hand over Borneo in exchange for the Federation taking Singapore. And so the Tunku arrived in Singapore on 26th May and reiterated to the press again that merger could only be considered when the Chinese population in Singapore was sufficiently Malayan conscious as to make Malaya the sole object of their loyalty. And his statement drew the usual exasperated, frustrated reply in the Chinese press. We are loyal to Malaya. The next day, 27th May 1961, in front of the Foreign Correspondents Association of Southeast Asia, the Tunku made a speech which emphasized unity. But of course, what he meant by unity was really assimilation to Malay domination. You see in his speech that he doesn't seem to see the difference between loyalty to the UMNO-led alliance government and loyalty to Malaya itself as a state, as an identity, as an ideal. His speech implies that they are the same thing. And not once in his speech does he mention merger. He only mentions, quote, closer understanding, unquote, with Singapore, Borneo, Brunei, and Sarawak. He talks of the territories as, quote, being brought closer together in political and economic cooperation, unquote. Not once in his speech does he mention merger or reunification. You can go read the speech in the Straits Times online if you want to see for yourself. The Tunku does not mention merger. Closer cooperation can mean anything. And it was a phrase he had used before. There is no way anyone could know that he was signaling an acceptance of merger. Only someone who was pre-warned, like Lee Kuan Yew, would have known what he meant. But in his autobiography, Lee Kuan Yew wrote that, and I'm quoting here, this was a bombshell. There had been no earlier indication of any change in his consistent stand that Malaya could not take Singapore in, unquote. This, of course, is a total and utter lie. Lee knew beforehand. And the proof is right there in what he writes, because Lee could not have known, could not have felt it was a bombshell at the time, because there is nothing in the Tunku speech that actually signals merger. Nothing. The only way Lee could have known that it was a bombshell, the only way he could have known that the Tunku was signaling merger, was if he knew about it beforehand and was nervously waiting to see if the Tunku would actually say it. Of course, almost no one else knew it was a bombshell. So the next day, for example, all the newspapers, English, Chinese, Malay, Tamil, reported the remarks with no more or less excitement than they had reported any of the Tunku's previous pronouncements that merger would be a good idea. Indeed, his words were almost identical to previous pronouncements. Instead, the immediate impact of his comments was seen as focusing on strengthening economic and cultural cooperation rather than merger. The Sinchu Jitpo commented that this plan for Greater Malaysia, comprising the Borneo territories as well, was kind of new, but something that would take 10 or 20 years to realize, and so for now was merely an ideal. And the Sinchu Jitpo uses those words, an ideal that the states would aim for. The newspapers continued to report the Tunku's comments as before, stressing the need for unity, harmony, and Malayan loyalty. So to everyone but the few people in the Singapore and Federation and British cabinets who knew, merger remained hypothetical and very unlikely in the immediate future. Indeed, a joint statement by six trade unionists, Lim Chin Siong, Fong Sui Suan, S. Woodhull, Dominic Puducherry, Jamit Singh, and S.T. Barney, marking National Day on 3rd of June, did not even mention merger. They had no idea that it was already starting. Instead, they focused entirely on the issue still foremost in their minds, which was reunifying a divided PAP and keeping the election promises, particularly on the detainee issue. And indeed, later, Lim Chin Siong was asked why the statement did not mention merger, and Chin Siong treated it as if it was still hypothetical and a long way off. So he replied, "Well, no one can guarantee that the people's rights of liberty and equality of opportunity would not be compromised by a merger with a state that explicitly put Malay interests first. Thus, the best way forward," he felt, "was to first give Singapore full internal self-government and to abolish the ISC to allow Singaporeans to freely decide for themselves." But eventually, the news of Lee Kuan Yew's secret deal with the Tunku and the other federation leaders would be revealed, and Lee would have to deal with the consequences. Join us when we return. Welcome back. Tunku Abdul Rahman and the Federation leaders had secretly agreed to rescue Lee Kuan Yew from his domestic situation by reunifying the Federation of Malaya with Singapore. But only they and a few select people in the PAP cabinet knew. Once news of this secret deal broke, it would have massive ramifications and reverberations in Singapore and around the region. But before that happened, the Tunku may actually yet have backed away again from merger. But this time, events progressed more quickly than anyone could have anticipated. 9 days before the Hong Lim election, the PAP assemblyman for Anson, Baharuddin bin Muhammad Arif, died of a sudden heart attack. His death triggered another by-election to be held 15th July 1961. The PAP leadership, who had treated Hong Lim as a referendum on their government, doubled down. They now declared Anson a second referendum on their government. Can you imagine? It's like people who lose a referendum demanding a second referendum. That's crazy. That's undemocratic. Anyway, the PAP leaders did the same thing as Hong Lim. They called it a referendum on their government. They vilified their opponents. They described apocalyptic scenarios if the PAP lost. And this, complained the Sin Chew Jit Po, simply returned Singapore to the same situation as before. The government was gambling on Anson to extricate them from a situation of their own making. But this time the PAP was the incumbent, and it was a safe seat with a healthy vote margin from the last election. Surely they could not lose this time? Well, into this growing storm cometh the hour, cometh the man. David Marshall was back, baby. David Marshall's decision to throw his hat into the ring further intensified the pressure on the PAP leadership. Marshall's well-established opposition to the Internal Security Council and his demands for the public trial or release of political detainees were policies shared by the PAP left. And Ong Eng Guan's victory at Hong Lim was seen as proof that these policies were popular among the electorate. And David Marshall was probably the one man, the only man outside of the Legislative Assembly who could defeat a PAP candidate in a straight fight. The PAP left begged the leadership to desist from their harsh, uncompromising rhetoric, pleading with them to return to the platform on which they had been elected, to keep their promises, to just listen to the people, please. But the PAP leadership refused, and they had a secret weapon. They knew that the Tunku and the British had agreed to merger. They knew merger was coming. And so, armed with the inside knowledge, the PAP leadership instead focused on merger, to the confusion and consternation of the PAP left and their own backbenchers, who had no idea why their leaders were suddenly so obsessed with merger. For example, Toh Chin Chai, at a rally on the 9th of June, reiterated that the only path to independence was through merger. Merger was inevitable, he said. And the PAP would solve Singapore's problems by, quote, complete independence through merger with the federation or merger with a larger federation, and would ensure that our socialist and Malayan approach to labour and educational programs are not jeopardised, unquote. And these statements were designed specifically to appeal to local Chinese concerns about labour and education. But no one cared The public response to the speeches did not pay much heed to these statements on merger. It was barely covered in the news articles and commentaries and discussions of the by-election. No one on social media discussed it. And by social media, I mean, of course, letters to the editors of the newspapers and, in all probability, all the discussion in the kopitiams. Because no one expected merger was actually going to happen anytime soon. Merger was a long, long, long way away. Why talk about merger when we have problems that we need to address right now? But at the end of June, British actions caught the attention of a surprised public and signaled that the process of merger was already underway. Around the 20th of June, the British Prime Minister, Harold Macmillan, publicly commented that the Tunku's 27th May announcement was a, quote, striking suggestion, unquote. On the 26th of June 1961, Lord Selkirk convened a roundtable conference of governors and officials in Singapore to discuss the Tunku's new pro-merger position. And at the end of the three-day conference, the governor of North Borneo, William Good, who podcast listeners will remember was governor of Singapore from 57 to 59, spoke of, quote, the need to seize the right moment to push through Tunku Abdul Rahman's Greater Malaysia Plan to ensure its success, unquote. And the next day, Lord Selkirk flew to London to brief Prime Minister Macmillan personally. Public opinion across Singapore and the Borneo territories erupted in surprise and shock and fear. The impression given by the actions and public comments of the British made Greater Malaysia seemed like a done deal, with the Singapore and the Borneo territories exchanging one colonial master, London, for another, Kuala Lumpur. The Singapore branch of the Parti Rakyat issued a press statement describing the plan as, quote, a very dangerous intrigue of the reactionary right-wing movement in conjunction with the British colonialists, unquote. A.M. Azahari, president of the Brunei Parti Rakyat, the territory's main opposition, declared his country should first attain independence, quote, before considering Tunku Abdul Rahman's Greater Malaysia proposal, unquote. On the 9th of July, Azahari, Ong Ki Hui, who's chairman of the Sarawak United People's Party, and Donald Stevens, leader of North Borneo's sizable non-Muslim indigenous Kadazan community, issued a joint statement expressing their opposition to any merger of the Borneo territories with Malaya along the lines of the Tunku's plan. Closer links could only be contemplated when the Borneo territories had become self-governing and they could talk, quote, as equals, not vassals, unquote. In Singapore, this development sharply altered the focus of the Anson by-election, with this Greater Malaysia plan now dominating discussion. The process of merger, as well as its final form, became the central issue of the by-election. Within the PAP, the shock was compounded by revelations that Lee Kuan Yew and Goh Keng Swee had been engaged in secret discussions with the Federation and the British since April. Lee had even prepared a paper for the British analysing alternatives for the constitutional future of the five territories. The abrupt about-face of the Tunku and the enthusiasm of the British for the plan raised huge suspicions. Why would either of them endorse the scheme if they did not stand to substantially benefit? Was Singapore being sold out? PAP backbenchers and members demanded to know what was going on and why the PAP leadership had left the government completely in the dark. They feared that the leadership was perpetuating colonialism under the guise of Malayan reunification. But the PAP leaders refused to explain. They kept hammering away and saying, merger, merger, merger. But what was merger? What kind of merger? How? And they would not explain. The continued frustration of the PAP left and backbenchers with the lack of intra-party democracy and consultation boiled over into the public sphere as they pushed the PAP leadership to disclose what they knew. Tell us something. Tell us anything. Just tell us the truth for once, or risk losing the Anson by-election. On 8th of July, 1 week before Anson polling day, the 6 trade union leaders, including Lim Chin Siong, criticized the PAP leadership for negotiating merger in secret, for doing a secret deal with no consultation to the elected representatives of the people of Singapore. After 2 years in which PAP leaders had done everything in secret, this was the final straw. They called on the PAP leadership to disclose the intended form and substance of merger, declaring, quote, "Anyone who allows the colonial power to control us through the right-wing forces, i.e. the forces in Kuala Lumpur, must be exposed," unquote. 8 of the PAP's backbenchers wrote a letter to Toh Chin Chai, declaring their support for the platform established by the 6 trade union leaders and calling for a conference of the party's 51 branches to examine its current role in the present political situation. Letters flew back and forth in the press between the PAP leaders and the PAP left, culminating in Lee Kuan Yew demanding the resignation of 3 political secretaries, Lim Chin Siong, S. Budhal, and Fong Swee Suan. Despite their avowed support of merger in principle, Lee spun their protest as opposition to any form of merger, saying, quote, "What is clear is that in order to stop merger, the 6 trade unionists are prepared to go to any lengths, even to destroying the party with which they are ostensibly associated," unquote. And at the same time, Toh Chin Chai tried to link merger to the economy, declaring that the PAP was only interested in what merger meant, quote, "to the workers who have worked today but may not have worked tomorrow, to the unemployed, to the 20,000 who come out every year to look for jobs, to the people of Singapore as a whole," unquote. Tempers frayed as the PAP split between those who wanted accountability, who wanted the truth, and those who were willing to trust Lee Kuan Yew. Accusations of betrayal flew. Friendships were destroyed. The left demanded that Lee Kuan Yew come clean. And on polling day, Anson's voters agreed. They elected David Marshall, whom the Sin Chew Jitpo called, quote, "the biggest cannon in the available arsenal for more effective debate and opposition in the Legislative Assembly," unquote. Campaigning on his pro-labour, pro-merger, pro-Merdeka platform that emphasised effective opposition to the PAP, Marshall won with 3,598 votes, that's 43.3%, to 3,052 votes, 36.7% for Mahmood, the PAP candidate and TUC chairman. Indeed, voter turnout was incredibly high, virtually full, 97.5%. And 2/3 of the voters voted against the PAP candidate, a swing of 24% from the 1959 general election. The Chinese press expressed hopes that the PAP would take this as a wake-up call, would heed this call for more open and productive governance, allowing the Legislative Assembly to debate productively on the issue of merger. They rubbished the PAP's claim that their loss was due to communist conspiracy, which of course it wasn't. As listeners to this podcast know, the conspiracy had been with Lee Kuan Yew, and the MCP had shown its impotence when it failed to make any headway in Hong Lim. Lee Kuan Yew again offered to resign. He had lost 2 by-elections in a row and lost the confidence of a majority of his own party. Lee's public letter of resignation described the dispute as, quote, "another test of strength between the non-communist left and the communist left," unquote, which the Chinese press rubbished as, quote, "exaggeration," unquote. The Sin Chew Jitpo wrote, quote, "to use such terms as pro-communist and communist to describe the political storms in Singapore is but a cheap stunt to use such simple inference indiscriminately to deal with all voices against the government. It will only bring about blind destruction and persecution and is definitely not beneficial to political reality," unquote. An emergency meeting of the PAP Central Executive Committee rejected Lee Kuan Yew's offer to resign. Party Chairman Toh Chin Chai noted that Lee had the full confidence of the CEC. But there was clearly a large faction of the party, a majority of the party even, which disapproved of Lee's leadership. And the PAP left anticipated that it would make no difference if it was Lee or Toh or anyone else in Lee Kuan Yew's faction as Prime Minister, the direction the party was heading in had caused it to lose public confidence. They had conspired against the party membership and possibly against the people of Singapore. With the majority of the party and public unhappy with the PAP leadership, it was only a matter of time before Lee and his supporters fell and they would have to be replaced. And they were not alone in this belief. British officials too began worrying that Lee was going to fall, and so they too began planning for that eventuality. And so join us next week as we discuss how they all planned for life after Lee Kuan Yew. As always, if you have any questions, comments or feedback, please email me at thehistoryofsingapore@gmail.com or visit my webpage at thehistoryofsingapore.com. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit Patreon, patreon.com/pjthumb. Thank you very much and see you next week.